Hello, this is Todd Durakon with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. Coming to you from my home studio, we start on the front page. Together Decatur, weather-eyed watchers needed. NWS trains public for vital work as storm spotters. And this article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. Decatur resident Charles Niebrugge remembers the twin tornadoes that hit the area in 1996. We were on Elwin Blacktop on top of the bridge, and we'd seen a tornado from Iliopolis go through town, he said. That thing must have been a mile wide, or a half mile wide, rather. As a trained storm spotter, Niebrugge knew what he was seeing. He took a class offered by the National Weather Service nearly 40 years ago to receive his certification. He continues to take the annual class since it is beneficial for him as a ham radio operator. I do it to refresh myself, Niebrugge said, and for myself and my family, so when I see it coming, I know I need to take cover. Ham radio operator Randy Young also is certified as a storm spotter, but admits he hadn't taken a class in a few years. I just want to renew my knowledge, he said, before a recent class at Richland Community College. Before taking the storm spotter class, Young admits he didn't know what to look for. Before that, I'd never seen a tornado ever, he said. From being in this class, I know where to look for them in the storm to see them. To become a certified storm spotter, participants are required to take part in the National Weather Service class. Information includes what to look for, how to report it, and how to stay safe. Recognizing conditions for tornadoes, heavy rains, hail, and flooding are a few of the topics. According to Rebecca Koppel, meteorologist from the National Weather Service in Lincoln, the public's help is needed during severe storms. Without you, we wouldn't know that there was a tornado ongoing in any of your towns, she said. All that we know is what the radar tells us. The National Weather Service only accepts information provided by trained storm spotters. With spring's volatile weather approaching, storm spotters will become an important asset to meteorologists. Peak season is from April to September, Koppel said. Anything can happen any time. Even with all the technology and equipment, meteorologists know they still need to gain the public's trust. People don't believe us, Koppel said to class participants. They'll only start answering and reacting to warnings after you've told us something is going on. Participants in the class often include first responders, farmers, and the ham radio operators. People listen to you, Koppel said. According to Tammy Schneider, Macon County Emergency Management Agency Coordinator, ham radio operators can be an emergency communications bridge if cell phone networks are down or overloaded. Ham radio is a broad range of frequencies and can serve as a lifeline for communications with local response agencies and other partners to support response operations, she said. Koppel and her coworkers want to educate the public on how to describe weather conditions. The more the public knows about severe weather, the better everyone is, she said. If they're more prepared, then we're more prepared, and the better information we're going to get out to the public. The meteorologist partnership with storm spotters provides what the professionals call ground truth. The public calling in, giving us reports, is giving us ground truth, telling us what the radar necessarily can't tell us, Koppel said. We can only see what's going on in the atmosphere. Storm spotters are another tool to help meteorologists communicate current conditions during a storm. It takes us all to do our part to have better prepared, resilient communities that can get through the storms and better recover from them when they occur, Schneider said. And a very large color photo here. Rebecca Koppel, a meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Lincoln, presents information during the annual storm spotter class at Richland Community College in Decatur on Thursday, March 6th. And she's shown on the stage with a very large drop-down screen behind her. And it says other rotations, gust nados is the screen slide they're showing. And the photo is taken from about the third seat on the right, looking up toward the stage, and there are several people in the seats. And the photo credit is Joseph Ressler Photos Herald and Review. And there's another photo, this time taken looking down the rows of seats of several attendees, all very focused on the presentation. Hashtag Together Decatur. Do you know a person or have a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur? Well, if you do, contact Donat Beckett at 217-421-6983 or dbeckett@herald-review.com. On the front page, environment, U.S. butterfly loss called catastrophic. This article is by Seth Borenstein, Associated Press, Washington. America's butterflies are disappearing because of insecticides, climate change, and habitat loss, with the number of the winged beauties down 22% since 2000. A new study finds the first countrywide systematic analysis of butterfly abundance found the number of butterflies in the lower 48 states fell on average 1.3% a year since the turn of the century, with 114 species showing significant declines and only 9 increasing, according to a study in Thursday's journal Science. Butterflies have been declining in the last 20 years, said study co-author Nick Haddad, an entomologist at Michigan State University, and we don't see any sign that that's going to end. A team of scientists combined 76,957 surveys from 35 monitoring programs and blended them for an apples-to-apples comparison, counting 12.6 million butterflies over the decades. Last month, an annual survey of just monarch butterflies, which federal officials plan to put on the threatened species list, counted a nearly all-time low of fewer than 10,000, down from 1.2 million in 1997. Many of the species in decline fell by 40% or more. David Wagner, a University of Connecticut entomologist who wasn't part of the study, praised its scope. He said, while the annual rate of decline may not sound significant, it is catastrophic and saddening when compounded over time. In just 30 or 40 years, we are talking about losing half the butterflies and other insect life over a continent, he said in an email. The tree of life is being denuded at unprecedented rates. The United States has 650 butterfly species, but 96 species were so sparse they didn't show up in the data, and another 212 species weren't found in sufficient numbers to calculate trends, said study leader author Colin Edwards, an ecologist and data scientist at the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm probably most worried about the species that couldn't even be included in the analyses because they were so rare, said University of Wisconsin-Madison entomologist Karen Oberhauser, who wasn't part of the research. Haddad, who specializes in rare butterflies, said in recent years he saw just 2 endangered St. Francis Satyr butterflies, which only live on a bomb range in Fort Bragg in North Carolina, so it could be extinct. Some well-known species had large drops. The Red Admiral, which is so calm it lands on people, is down 44%, and the American Lady Butterfly, with 2 large eye spots on its back wings, decreased by 58%, Edward said. Even the invasive white cabbage butterfly, a species that is well adapted to invade the world, according to Haddad, fell by 50%. How can that be, he wondered. Cornell University butterfly expert Anurag Agarwal said he worries most about the future of a different species, humans. The loss of butterflies, parrots, and porpoises is undoubtedly a bad sign for us, the ecosystems we need and the nature we enjoy, Agarwal, who wasn't part of the study, said in an email. They are telling us that our continent's health is not doing so well. Butterflies are an ambassador for nature's beauty, fragility, and the interdependence of species. They have something to teach us. Oberhauser said butterflies connect people with nature that calms us down, makes us healthier and happier, and promotes learning. What's happening to butterflies in the United States is probably happening to other less studied insects across the continent and world, Wagner said. He said not only is this the most comprehensive butterfly study, but the most data-rich for any insect. Edwards said when they looked at butterfly species that lived both in the hotter south and cooler north, the ones that did better were in the cooler areas. The biggest decrease in butterflies was in the southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma, where the number of butterflies dropped by more than half in the 20 years. It looks like butterflies that are in dry and warm areas are doing particularly poorly, Edwards said. And that kind of captures a lot of the Southwest. Butterflies are pollinators, though not as prominent as bees, and are a major source of pollination of the Texas cotton crop, Haddad said. Climate change, habitat loss, and insecticides tend to work together to weaken butterfly populations, Edwards and Haddad said. Of the three, it seems that insecticides are the biggest cause, based on previous research from the U.S. Midwest, Haddad said. It makes sense because insecticide use has changed in dramatic ways in the time since our study started, Haddad said. Habitats can be restored, and so can butterflies, so there's hope, he said. You can make changes in your own backyard, in your neighborhood, and in your state, Haddad said. That could really improve the situation for a lot of species. Now move on to A3 local and state. Drug dealer admits killing customer. This article's by Tony Reed, Decatur. Eric L. Hardy, the Decatur drug dealer who got into a fist fight with one of his customers and beat the man to death, is pleading guilty to a charge of second-degree murder. His trial on murder charges in the September 1st, 2023 killing of 53-year-old Marvin E. Meyer Jr. had been due to get underway Monday in Macon County Circuit Court. But a court docket entry shows that the 34-year-old defendant appeared in court March 6th and took a plea deal negotiated by Chief Public Defender Michelle Sanders. The new second-degree charge states that Hardy inflicted blows that caused the death of Meyer, but adds at the time of the killing, he believed the circumstances to be such that if they existed, would justify or exonerate the killing under principles of self-defense, but his belief was unreasonable. Hardy made the guilty plea in return for the original three alternate murder charges being dismissed by presiding Judge Thomas Griffith, who also dismissed a charge of aggravated battery. An open sentence hearing is now scheduled for April 17th, which means there is no agreed cap on prison time, and the degree of punishment will be left up to the judge to decide. The second-degree murder charge has a sentencing range of 4 to 20 years in prison and is probation eligible. Hardy remains held in the custody of the Macon County Jail while awaiting his sentencing. A sworn affidavit about the case filed by the Decatur Police Department said Hardy had made weekly deliveries of crack cocaine to a house in the 1600 block of East Wood Street that Meyer shared with several other men. The affidavit said Meyer had fallen behind on his payments and owed Hardy $400. A witness told detectives that on the day of the murder, Hardy told him and another resident to leave their shared living room because the dealer wanted to be alone with Meyer. The witness states he goes into his own bedroom and a fight ensues between Eric and Marvin, said Detective Jeremy Appenzeller, who signed the affidavit. The witness then exits the room and observes Marvin on the floor with Eric repeatedly punching and kicking Marvin. He then observes Eric assist Marvin off the living room floor and assists Marvin into Marvin's bedroom. Police were called after Hardy left, and officers found the fatally injured victim in bed with blood streaming from facial injuries. Emergency room doctors at Decatur Memorial Hospital later said Meyer was suffering from internal bleeding, a collapsed lung, a lacerated liver, and he died as a medical team fought to save him. Police: man pulls gun and ends game. Tony Reed, Decatur. An argument over a game prompted an 18-year-old suspect to pull a gun and point it at the head of the boy he was playing against, police report. The Decatur boy later told officers he had defended himself by punching Nicholas E. Ellis, the accused gunman, and a fight ensued at the child's home in the 2500 block of North Dunn Drive. A sworn affidavit filed by Decatur Police Department said Ellis then fled the scene on the afternoon of February 24th, but he was soon in the custody of police officers who showed up later that day at his home in the 2500 block of Easy Street and arrested him after questioning him. Police said Ellis at first denied having a gun or threatening the boy with it, but later confessed and told officers they could find the weapon on the couch where he sleeps. The firearm turned out to be a Derringer 22 caliber two-shot Magnum handgun that police say was loaded. Nicholas also showed DPD officers a picture on Instagram of him holding a firearm, which he said was a .22, police said. The gun's serial number showed it had been reported stolen out of Waterloo, Iowa, while a check of Ellis's own history revealed he was free on pretrial release after being charged in November with battery, an offense he denies. Macon County Circuit Court Judge Lindsay Shelton denied him pretrial release when he appeared before her February 25th on the gun charges. These include aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, the aggravated unlawful possession of a gun, and the possession of a stolen firearm. Ellis is scheduled to be back in court Wednesday for a preliminary hearing when he will enter formal pleas to the charges. Environment Agency plans open house. This article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. The community is invited to the Macon County Environmental Management open house from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, March 18th, to view the new facility located at 151 West Wood Street in Decatur. The space is situated at the south end of the building. No items will be accepted for recycling during the open house. The event is an opportunity to meet members of the staff and learn about resources available. Refreshments and freebies will also be available. Visitors also can register to win a rain barrel. For more information, visit the Macon County Environmental Management at macon-green.com or call 217-425-4505. Man accused of stealing furnace, Tony Reed, Decatur. Police report that Michael R. Webb didn't want his girlfriend to share a Decatur home with him without heat, so he went back to the public housing she had been evicted from and stole the furnace. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department said it was hooked up and running when officers arrived at Webb's house in the 4600 block of North Neely Avenue, which had been without heat previously, to execute a search warrant February 16th. Weather records show the high that day was minus 1 and the lows minus 11 degrees. Officer Jeffrey Hockaday, who signed the affidavit, said the 37-year-old defendant had also ripped out the water heater from his girlfriend's former public housing home in the 1700 block of North 31st Street, but he hadn't had time to hook that up yet. Webb is described as having shared his girlfriend's former home with both her and a 39-year-old male housemate. He was present when officers arrived to execute the search warrant at the home on North Neely and is quoted as telling them the furnace and water heater had been stolen. The housemate said Michael broke into the house on North 31st Street where he stole the water heater and furnace because he wanted the 27-year-old girlfriend to have heat, said Hockaday. The officer said estimates to replace stolen furnace and water heater can carry out repairs ranged up to more than $8,000. Police had already been hot on Webb's trail after copper piping had been stolen from the North 31st Street home, and Webb had made repeated visits to a Decatur recycling firm trying to sell more than 13 pounds of pipe. Webb had been back there again on January 31st trying to sell copper wire, and this time a suspicious employee called the police. Hockaday said the worker had tried to disguise the call to keep Webb around until the officer arrived, but the defendant had grown suspicious and fled, leaving his latest batch of stolen goods behind. Police had tracked him down and arrested him February 21st, and he now faces a charge of burglary. He had been granted pretrial release and is due back in Macon County Circuit Court on Wednesday for a preliminary hearing where he will enter a formal plea to the charge. Current state flag wins redesign vote. Bridget Fox, Capital News, Illinois, Springfield, has this story. The Illinois state flag may be around a lot longer, it turns out. About 43% of the 385,000 votes in an advisory state flag revision contest decided they'd prefer to resist change and keep the current design. There were 12 other flag choices. 10 were designed by Illinois residents, students, and even the great-grandchildren of Civil War veteran and past Illinois Attorney General James McCartney. The remaining two were designed for past state anniversary celebrations. A flag design depicting the sun on the horizon, designated design number 2246, finished in second place, with design number 3679 finishing in third place. That design depicts Abraham Lincoln's silhouette and the state of Illinois on a dark blue background. A flag designed for the state's sesquicentennial celebration in 1968 finished in last place, with about 5,100 votes. The flag will be used by the Illinois Flag Commission to advise the, or rather the vote will be used by the Illinois Flag Commission to advise the General Assembly on how they should vote regarding a flag change. So legislators will have the final say on any future flag changes. Senator Doris Turner, Democrat Springfield, introduced the bill that created the flag state, the Illinois State Flag Commission, the group that conducted the flag vote. She's also a member of the commission. Turner said she doesn't have any preconceived notions about what's going to happen. I don't want to talk too much about the results because I think that the commission still has work to do, Turner said. And we have to look at those results and do a deep dive into them and complete our report and submit it to the General Assembly, as we said we would do in the legislation. The Flag Commission is expected to issue its report to the legislature later this spring. Alice Jr. coming to Milliken's stage. This article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. Milliken University's Kirkland Fine Arts Center and the Decatur Park District will present the Disney classic Alice in Wonderland Jr. Showtimes will be 7:30 p.m. Friday, March 21st and Saturday, March 22nd and 2 p.m. Saturday, March 22nd and Sunday, March 23rd at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center on the Milliken campus. Tickets are $10 and can be purchased on the Decatur Park District's website, in person at the Kirkland Fine Arts Ticket Office, or by calling the Kirkland Ticket Office at 217-424-6318. The show features young performers from the Decatur community and is a stage adaptation of the 1951 film Alice in Wonderland. Popular songs from the musical include The Golden Afternoon, The Unbirthday Song, and Painting the Roses Red, and a few new songs created for the 2010 live-action film. Here's an interesting article on the weather page. Study dates ancient bone tools made by humans. This article's by Christina Larson, Associated Press. Washington. Early humans regularly used animal bones to make cutting tools 1.5 million years ago. A newly discovered cache of 27 carved and sharpened bones from elephants and hippos found in Tanzania's Olduvai Gorge site pushes back the date for ancient bone tool use by about 1 million years. Researchers know that early people made simple tools from stones as early as 3.3 million years ago. The new discovery, published Wednesday in Nature, reveals that ancient humans had rather more complex toolkits than previously we thought, incorporating a variety of materials, said William Harcourt Smith, a paleoanthropologist at the American Museum of Natural History, who was not involved in the research. The well-preserved bone tools, measuring up to about 16 inches, likely were made by breaking off the thick ends of leg bones and using a stone to knock off flakes from the remaining bone shaft. This technique was used to create one sharpened edge and one pointed tip, said the study co-author Ignacio de la Torre, a researcher at the Spanish National Research Council. Excuse me. The bone tools were probably used as a hand axe, a handheld blade that's not mounted on a stick, for butchering dead animals, he said. Such a blade would be handy for removing meat from elephant and hippo carcasses, but not used as a spear or projectile point. We don't believe that they were hunting these animals, he said. They were probably scavenging. Some of the artifacts show signs they were struck to remove flakes more than a dozen times, revealing persistent craftsmanship. The uniform selection of the bones, large and heavy leg bones from specific animals, and the consistent pattern of alteration makes it clear that early humans deliberately chose and carved these bones, said Miriam Pacheco, a paleobiologist at the Federal University of São Carlos in Brazil, who was not involved in the study. The bones show minimal signs of erosion, trampling, or gnawing by other animals, ruling out the possibility that natural causes resulted in the tool shapes, she added. The bone tools date from more than a million years before our species, Homo sapiens, arose about 300,000 years ago. At the time the tools were made, three different species of human ancestors lived in the same region of East Africa, said Brianna Pobinar, a paleoanthropologist at the Smithsonian's Human Origins Program, who was not involved in the study. The tools may have been made and used by Homo erectus, Homo habilis, or Paranthropus bossei. It could have been any of these three, Popener said, but it's almost impossible to know which one. In a large color photo here, researcher Ignacio de la Torre holds a bone tool found in Tanzania's Olduvai Gorge in 2023 at the Spanish National Research Council Pleistocene Archaeology Lab in Madrid. And it looks just like a sharpened piece of stone, maybe, I don't know, 8 inches long. Okay, and close up here, a bone tool, here being probed with an instrument. Looks like just a flattened, sharpened rock here. Okay. Angeliki Theodoropoulou, photos, Spanish National Research Council. Well, since we're on the weather page and we have a few minutes left in this first half hour, let's go ahead and read this. On B6, Decatur four-day forecast today. Partly sunny and warm, wind west-northwest 6 to 12 miles per hour, high of 65. Tonight, a moonlit sky, wind east 7 to 14 miles per hour, low of 39. Wednesday, partly sunny and warm, wind south-southwest 7 to 14 miles per hour, high of 70 and low of 45. Thursday, partly sunny and warm, wind east-southeast 6 to 12 miles per hour, high of 72 and low of 50. Friday, increasingly windy, wind south-southeast 15 to 25 miles per hour, high of 76 and low of 55. The regional outlook warm today with sun and some clouds. Expect 4 to 8 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity, 55%, and good drying conditions. A moonlit sky tonight, average relative humidity, 70%. Skywatch, sunrise 7:13 a.m., set 6:58 p.m. Moonrise, 4:34 p.m., set 6:12 a.m. Full moon, March 14th. Last quarter moon, March 22nd. New moon, March 29th. And first quarter moon, April 4th. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour.